in my last stretch of a period of time on teaching staff, my last two things that I'll be teaching will be on the death penalty. Today is the first of those days, and I'll do another one on Wednesday morning at 10:45. Wednesday morning, I'm going to be really addressing the moral and ethical issues and the faith issues for us as Christians. Today, I'm going to talk more about policy, and I'm going to tell you both days, I'll tell you some stories. So welcome to this class. I call the whole series Paths Untrodden, Perils Unknown, which is a line out of the Holden Prayer. If you have difficulty hearing, actually, there's a hearing assistance device that I can get. Would you like me to get that?
Yes, one of it doesn't do too well.
Oh, I'm sorry. Aren't I supposed to pin something on me then or something? I mean, I think there is a...
That's fine.
Okay, I apologize. I'll try to talk louder. I have a soft voice. I'm sorry. So I've been doing something called Paths Untrodden and Perils Unknown, partly because of the work I do now, which is work on death penalty issues. And I'm so struck by how the path you lead in your life leads somewhere. So almost inevitably, it takes you to a place. And if your path has been relatively peaceful through your childhood and pretty positive, the place you end up is often quite good. And if your path along the way has been really rocky, often you end up in trouble. So I do volunteer work with prostitutes, and I talked about them a couple days ago here, and that sort of notion was born out there, and this work with death penalty, I think it is again born out. So I'm glad for the opportunity to be here and talk with you about this work, because I've only been doing it for a year and a half, and I really need Holden as a kind of a touchstone to help me think through what I think about it. So thanks for coming today. There is a quote here that I want to read to you from Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg. He said once that the deliberate institutionalized taking of human life by the state is the greatest degradation of the human personality imaginable. Although most developed nations in the world have abandoned the death penalty, the United States, which purports to be a leader in the protection of human rights, retains capital punishment. 38 states, the federal government, and the military provide for death as a punishment for certain crimes. Over 3,700 people are on death rows across the country. So that's the situation we're in. I'm going to tell you what my job is. I'm what they call a mitigation specialist. It's a pretty new field. It's been around for about 10 years. And most states have them now that have the death penalty. Mitigation is the kind of argument you put on opposite of aggravation. And those arguments are made during the sentencing part of a trial. So I work for lawyers and for the county of Cook in Illinois, specifically on specific clients working on the sentencing part of their trial. You know how trials have pretrial motions, which sometimes in these cases can go on for years, and then they have the trial itself, which is either won or lost. And if the trial is lost, then you do sentencing. The sentencing, if you have a jury trial, can start the next day after the trial is lost. Or if you have a bench trial, it's often 28 days later. And I work for about a year ahead of time. So all of the work that the state pays me to do, we hope, will be in vain in each case. But if the client is found guilty, then we put on sentencing. And sentencing can take half a day, or 15 minutes, or a week, or depending on the lawyer, and on the case, and on the story of the person. But I gather and assemble and talk through and give voice to whatever we want to say in the defense on the sentencing part of a trial. So what I do then is I meet the client to start with. I go into the jail and sit down with the person and say, I'm here to work on the sentencing. And he says, sentencing, we're going to win this trial. And I say, well, you never know what a jury will do. We might win it and we might not. And so I have to constantly remind him, because I go back very often to see him, constantly remind him that the fact that I'm back there so often paying so much attention to him on sentencing doesn't mean that the lawyer's not working on the case itself. And the lawyer is working on the case itself. In Illinois, we have very good public defenders, and they have an excellent reputation for working on capital cases. But I interview the client. I go and talk to him and I say, I need to know everything about your life. And the client thinks I'm lying, of course, because they think I want to just fill out a form and, you know, tick off stuff. Did you ever have the measles? But I don't do that. I listen a lot, and I ask follow-up questions, and I probe a little bit, and I start to build some trust between me and the client. I get contact visits in the jail, so the family and the friends of the client visit with them through a glass, a thick piece of glass with a little hole in it. Often the little hole is down low, so people have to lean over to talk through the hole, shout through the hole at each other. But I get to sit down in a room with this person. Sometimes the room, depending on the section of the jail, it's in a basement, it's like a dungeon. It's got wet floors and dripping pipes and clanking and mice and rats, and it's like that. Sometimes it's in a very slick, modern part of the jail where it's so sterile that you almost never see another human being. You'd go through locked door after locked door, you know, and that one guard will take me in there and then take the client into a room. And the room, the door goes, is hermetically sealed. When the door closes, it's silent. And then I sit there, or sometimes it's somewhere in between. It's a library in a jail, which has a few old tattered paperbacks and not much else. But, you know, it's a reasonably pleasant setting. Almost never a window. So where I sit with a client varies, but the nice thing is that I'm face to face with them. And most of my clients are 18, 19, 20 year old kids. You know, and I'm their mom. I mean, I come in there and, well, I'm white and most of them are not, but there I am. So I start out by asking them how they are. And then I do follow-up questions on the previous time. I ask them to tell me about their lives. And then in the 2 weeks until I come again, I follow up on the clues that they've given me. So I go and interview their mother in the community. I go and interview their father. I go and interview their siblings. I go and interview their cousins, their friends. I find their old school teachers. I find their pastors. I find anybody I can find that knew this person growing up, and I ask for the story. So I get lots and lots of stories.
Is that both sexes you work with?
I do theoretically, but most people on death row or in capital cases are men. So I have not had a woman, but I haven't been in this business for very long. So I have a good friend who is a woman client right now. She's a Lutheran pastor. My friend is, not the client, but but as you will soon see, it could be my friend, the Lutheran pastor, who's on death row, because there's a lot of mistakes made in this business.
You're hired by the state or by the attorney?
I'm hired, in most cases, by the public defender's office, by the Capital Crimes Unit, and in one case, by the Northwestern Legal Clinic. Okay. Which is, again, takes indigent clients. An example of what I talked to a client about in jail is a few weeks ago, I had noticed that one of my 19-year-old kids was talking very often. He would tell me a story about someone and say, he's dead now, or she's dead now, or that person died, just sort of casually in the process of telling a story. I'd say, what is their phone number? And they'd say, they're dead now. So I said to him 4 weeks ago, your assignment for 2 weeks from now is to write down the names of everyone you know who has died. And so he came obediently in the next time with his list, and he had 19 names on the list.
Wow.
And I said, okay, today you're going to tell me the story of each one of those deaths. So we sat for 3.5 hours, and we went through death after death after death after death. This kid was 19. He knew 19 dead people, and his sister who had died before he knew her. So there were 20 in his life, but he only thought of 19 because he'd forgotten that his sister died. There's a lot of sadness in this business. There's a lot of sadness, of course, everywhere. But so then, when it comes time for the sentencing, I would say this to the lawyer: this sister has a good voice and is a credible person and can tell this part of the story. Or the mother can come in, and she's a crack addict and she's pretty pathetic, but she can say to the judge, please spare his life. Or this person who was the housekeeper in that family can come in and say, all the while I lived in that family, the mother was beating the father was beating the mother. And so she can tell that story from a sort of outsider's point of view. So I try to think, who gives voice to this? How do I tell the story that I want to tell? And there are three kinds of things that I look for as a mitigator, because they'll touch the jury's heart, basically. One kind of thing is, I want stories about what a nice person my client is. Now, obviously, my client is a terrible person because he's committed a murder or several murders. So I have to believe, and I do believe in my heart, that we are all not the worst thing we ever did. All of us have done terrible things. We haven't done maybe as terrible as some of my clients. But I believe in grace and forgiveness, and I believe that we all make mistakes and bad choices. So I want to tell the good stories, obviously, about my client. I want to tell how he helped his grandmother through a rough period, or how kind he was consistently to other children, or whatever. I think, would you mind closing that door? I think we're probably ready to close it. So I look for those stories. What stories about being a sweetheart? I have one fairly... I have one very challenging client to me now, who is a white 50-year-old drunk man who's been drunk since he was 16, basically, and on the streets. And all the while he was a child, he helped. His mother was diabetic. She was a waitress. She worked very hard. And she couldn't deal with the needles. And in those days, you know, he's 50 now, so when he was six, this started from six until about 15. He got up every morning and cleaned the needles and injected his mother. And you know, that's an important story. I mean, a six-year-old learning to do that to help his mother. So I look for all kinds of redeeming stories about the client. The second thing I look for is the stories of what a terrible life he's had. And those stories, of course, are abundant. But the terribleness of the life, well, it has vivid pictures, it has specifics, it has content, and it's not sometimes unremittingly terrible. People have very mixed lives, but I try to find that story. And the third kind of thing I look for is I try to figure out if I think this client has something diagnosable, something that a doctor would be able to diagnose. So it could be a chemical imbalance, it could be brain injuries. I always ask a lot of questions about, did you ever get hurt as a child? Did you ever get taken to the doctor? I'm going to show you a video later of one of my clients, and he has a very bad scar over his eye. His mother threw a knife at him when he was 7, and she didn't take him to the doctor. So it's unrepaired. But as much as possible, I then get their medical records, I get their educational records, I get their incarceration records, so that I can document as much as I can what has happened to them in their life. And then we do in Illinois have enough money so that we can order tests, we can order neuropsych evaluations, or whatever we need to order in the way of medical testing. So that's what I do. Leroy Orange, who's one of my clients. I'm going to tell you about one person in particular, my first client, who has not yet gone to trial, just to tell you his life story in brief. He's now 21. He was arrested when he was just 18. He was born in Jamaica of a mother who was 15. She was a 15-year-old girl who was the brightest and best and firstborn child, not firstborn, but brightest and best in the parents' estimation, and prettiest, of quite a well-to-do, well-established family in the farm country of Jamaica. So they didn't have electricity or things like that, but very respected family there. And they were absolutely humiliated when their 15-year-old daughter got pregnant, and furious with her. And so the child was obviously not welcome. And she got pregnant not with some boy she was dating, but with some boy who she had a roll in the hay with, basically. And he was a guy who was impregnating a lot of young women in the neighborhood. He was an older guy, and he was charming and suave, you know, but not respected, not a good family. So the product of that single roll in the hay was my client, who was not a welcome baby. Nonetheless, the mother, 15-year-old mother, nursed him for a year and cared for him as well as she could. She was actually 14 when she got pregnant, so most of the time that she was with him, she was 15. And then her mother decided she was getting too attached to her baby, and the baby was getting to the point where he might be verbal. And the grandmother said, "This baby's gonna call me mama, not you." And she sent the child away, her daughter away to England. So that the baby was nursing with his mother one day and was without that the next. And that was, anybody who's had a one-year-old child and has been in that situation knows that that would be something of a shock to that child. Then he was raised in that family in Jamaica by the grandparents. The grandfather beat the grandmother, and the boy, by the time he was six, was so upset by this that he at one point threw a pot of soup, hot soup, onto the grandfather to force him to distract from beating the grandmother, and then he ran like crazy so that the grandfather wouldn't beat him. That's one story I've had corroborated from several different sources. This is a family where there was a young woman taken into the family at a very early age to be the mother's helper. The young woman was taken in when she was a five-year-old. And so she was the mother's helper all through my client's youth there. So she was a good source. She was an independent source. Her parents lived nearby. They didn't have enough money to have another child. You know, these stories get intertwined. So when Raymond was seven, his mother, who'd been living in England now for 6 years in London, called for him. So for the second time, he was taken out of the only home he ever had ever known. I mean, the first time was when his mother left him. The second time was when she reclaimed him. Of course, as a seven-year-old, he had no memory of his mother. But he got on an airplane and flew to England. And the mother was living with a sister of hers and two brothers of hers. She hadn't talked to him on the telephone, nothing during those intervening 6 years. He moved into that household and found that the mother was pretty hard to get along with, that she was somehow, she obviously had very ambivalent feelings about this kid, but the aunt and the two uncles were great. So he adjusted to living in London from this country road in Jamaica, and did very well in school, and did so well in school that when it was time for him to go on to high school, he, as a impoverished black child in London, was given a full scholarship to the Westminster City Boys School in downtown London, right by Westminster Cathedral. And he was thrilled, because he was a good student. He wore his little navy blue, you know, with gold buttons, sport jacket and a striped tie, and he got on the train every day from their neighborhood and rode downtown. And he was doing fine at the Westminster City Boys School. Then, a year and some into that high school experience, his mother, who was back in Jamaica by then, the mother had left London somewhere during those years when he was living there, She moved back to Jamaica. She mainly moved because of boyfriends here and there, you know, and she had a boyfriend there. So she decided she wanted him there. So Raymond moved back to Jamaica. Left the school. Left his happy life. His, you know, the mother was jealous that he was closer to her siblings than he was to her. And so there was some bad feelings there. In Jamaica, he came in the middle of the school year, had a hard time getting into a school, finally got into a trade school that he had to ride a bus a long way to, and he, you know, it was not intellectually stimulating to him. But he made the best of it, and he got going in this school and adjusted to living without electricity on a dirt road again after being downtown London. And really made the best of it. And soon after he got there, the mother decided to move to the United States. So, she was in the United States. He was back with his grandmother, living in this place. At that point, when she moved to the United States, the brothers and sisters in London said, please send him back to us. When she had called for him from London, they had said, please leave him with us. He's doing so well. But no. So he went on living in Jamaica through another year, and then the mother in the United States, guess what she did? She called for him. So he moved to Chicago. Then he made another successful adjustment. They moved to the suburb of Evanston, which is the first suburb just north of Chicago, and it's quite a wealthy suburb. It has some apartments. She rented an apartment with a cousin of hers, and so she could afford it. It's got a wonderful high school, ETHS, Evanston Township High School, national reputation, with a Jamaican club, a soccer team, all the teams of the sports that he knew how to play, you know, from England. And he just made a wonderful adjustment. He did it again. He adjusted, he was a good sport, he joined the Jamaican club, he joined every team in sight, he was on the honor roll. And after a year and a half, she never seemed to make these moves in the summertime, you know, between years. But actually this next one came at the beginning of October, so he was a month in. And he had got his first girlfriend, and he invited her to the prom at ETHS. So this was one happy camper at this point. And his mother decided she didn't like his friends at ETHS, and she moved to a distant suburb. And she didn't tell him they were moving until the day they moved. The moving truck came, they got in the car following the moving truck, and they drove out of Evanston, and he said, where are we going? Where are we going? And she said, oh, we're moving to, and she named a distant suburb, where there were no kids of color, no Jamaican club, nothing that he wanted, and of course his new girlfriend wasn't there. And he threw a fit. And this is a kid that was peaceful to a fault. Nobody had told any story about him ever doing anything the least bit violent, except throwing that pot of soup on the grandfather. So he, in the car, he reports that he lost it. He screamed, he yelled, he kicked, he just lost it. And then they got to the new high school in the new town, and he didn't study, he flunked out, he didn't perform, and eventually they kicked him out, and then he joined a gang. And he joined a gang partly because it was the only kids of color there. There were a few Latino kids in the gang, mostly white. But mostly he had just had it. He was fed up. He couldn't make another adjustment. There were a couple of complications in his brain. He was raised all the time he was in Jamaica. His grandparents' house in Jamaica was about 2 miles from an enormous aluminum factory. And the aluminum factory was so toxic that nothing grew for miles around it. The aluminum company provided new zinc roofs for every house within a 10-mile radius every year because the aluminum fallout was so corrosive that the roofs wouldn't last. And the aluminum company also delivered water to every house within 10 miles every week. So this kid was out playing in the dirt, he was swimming in the water there, he was raising, his grandma was raised, trying to raise vegetables and all that aluminum fallout, and he was breathing the air. So there was that in his brain, and he had also had at least 6 occasions of going unconscious with falls or accidents as a child, and he was never hospitalized for any of them. So there's no medical record of it, but there's lots of anecdotal records. So those are the 2 things about his brain that you need to know. Once he joined this gang, he was new in the gang, and he was a real follower, everybody reported, and he was told that the gang leader had been jailed, and the gang kids, or boys, or young men, had to raise $2,000 to bail the gang leader out of jail. So they sat around strategizing, and of course their kids and their harebrained, you know, they made just stupid plans. And was, you know, you hear them tell the story, and you think, what were they thinking of? But they were determined to come through for their leader, so one of the plans he came up with was 3 of them went into a jewelry repair shop on a little shopping strip out in the suburb somewhere, and they were going to steal some jewelry, you know, ask to look at it, the secondhand jewelry that was for sale there. And the weapon that they took was a lead pipe to enforce this. And they tried to rob the guy objected, and my client hit the guy over the head a couple of times and he went down behind the counter. My client had the lead pipe. He was told he had to have the lead pipe because he was the newcomer in the gang and therefore he had to carry the weapon. Then he did an interesting thing. He went around the counter and wailed on who was already, according to the coroner, probably a dead man, 20 more times. This is a person who'd never done a violent thing in his life except throw a pot of soup on his grandfather. And he hit him 20 more times, according to what he's being accused of having done. We don't know. We weren't there. We don't know what happened, but and he denies it. So he went totally nuts. He did this, I mean, a crime of passion, wouldn't you say? It would be like you hated someone. And this guy was a total stranger, this jewelry repair guy. And then he went home and took a nap, is what his friends say. He went to sleep. Oh, the third physical thing about him was that his shot through his family is hypoglycemia. He's low blood sugar problems and migraine headaches in accompanying that. This crime happened in the morning and nobody had eaten since the day before. He's now been in jail for 3 years awaiting trial, and he has a perfect record in jail. He has done not one bad thing. Every guard ends up giving him extra responsibility, he's working in the school in the jail. He does tutoring. During midday lockup in the jail, they don't lock him up. They keep him out to be their trustee, their assistant. He's the most helpful, sweet, accommodating guy. And he has this one episode in his life of totally being nuts. Maybe he didn't do it. Maybe he's right. I mean, he confessed to the crime. He confessed after being locked up for 2 days, sitting on a bench with his arm locked to the wall. And I don't know if he did it or not. But that's one story about one person. So keep that story in mind as I tell you a few more things. I do want to get through this. There's the choir people going to sing in the choir. I want to get through this video, too, that I want to show you a 10-minute clip out of about another of my clients. I want to tell you a few things about the death penalty. The ways people kill people in the United States with legal sanctioning, the government-instituted death. 3 states use hanging, 6 use a gas chamber, 11 use electrocution, 4 use a firing squad, and lethal injection are all the rest. And some of these have choices among these methods, and either the method is determined by the severity of the crime, sometimes the prisoner gets to choose which method, but this is what we do. the ages in the United States that we give people the death penalty. In three states, if you're 14 when you committed the crime, you can receive death. In eight states, it's unspecified. So presumably an eight-year-old could get death penalty. In 10 states, the age is 16. In four states, it's 17, and in 15 states, and for the federal crimes, it's age 18. If your state, I have all the states are here in a statistical printout that I got from the U.S. Department of Justice. So if you want to look up afterwards whether your state, what your state's policies are about what qualifies someone for death and whether or not you have death and what methods of execution you use, you can look through here. 3,700 people are now on death row. Well, these numbers are a year and a half old, so the number's grown a little bit. 34 states have the death penalty. I think it's 34. One is suspended, that's Illinois. The federal government has a death penalty for 43 separate crimes. So even if your state doesn't have the death penalty, the federal government, there could be a federal crime in your state, and so that you would end up executing somebody in your state. Like Minnesota doesn't have the death penalty, but there still could be an execution in Minnesota for a federal crime. And the armed services have death penalty. Since we have reinstituted the death penalty, which we did in the mid-70s, for a while it was suspended or illegal and then it was reinstituted, 92 people have been found to be completely innocent who are on death row and have been released from their crime, from their imprisonment. Of those 92, many of them have been released through DNA testing. Others have been released because someone else has been found to be actually guilty and has confessed and has a much more credible story about it. Or, you know, there are a variety of reasons, but 92 as of 2000 had been found innocent. Globally, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what's going on in terms of the United States and the rest of the world. The federal government and many states have expanded the use of the death penalty in the last 25 years, while the rest of the world has been abandoning it. In this country, the federal government adopted the death penalty in 1988. That's just the federal government. The states had gone back to it in the mid-70s and expanded it to over 40 crimes in 1994 and restricted federal review of capital cases in 1996. In the rest of the world, 35 countries have abandoned capital punishment since 1985. During that time, only four countries globally that did not have capital punishment adopted it, and one of them has since abolished it again. That was Nepal. Only one other member of NATO, Turkey, has the death penalty, but Turkey doesn't exercise it, so they don't execute people. Four countries accounted for 80% of all the executions that took place in the world last year. They were China, Iran, the Congo, and
the United States. The axis of evil.
Since 1990, only six countries have executed people who were under 18 at the time of the crime. Iran, Nigeria, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and
United States.
In that rather undistinguished company, the United States leads by far in the number executed. The United States is only one of two countries that have not ratified the International Covenant on the Rights of the Child, which, among other things, would prohibit the execution of people who were children at the time of the crime. The other country is Somalia. So that's where we stand globally. Makes you proud to be an American. But there is a growing dis-ease among many communities in this country about the lack of fairness in the way the death penalty is applied. And part of that is that we have a strong sense that it is the American Bar Association in 1977 said that they, although they're not opposed to the death penalty in principle, but year after year, it calls upon the states to improve the quality of counsel assigned to the poor, to respond to racial discrimination in the criminal justice system, and to stop executing the mentally ill, the mentally retarded, and children. Now, just 2 weeks ago, we finally reversed our policy nationally on executing the mentally retarded. We haven't yet defined who a mentally retarded person is, so that'll have to all be litigated out. But the ABA has gotten its way in that one respect, but we still execute children, the mentally ill. There's an extremely racist way that the death penalty is applied. One of the worst things about it is that many states still do not provide capable lawyers to defend those facing death at trial, and some do not provide counsel at all. In the later stages of review. So in the appeal stages, people can be standing before the bar with their life at stake and be indigent and not have a lawyer. So it's really a situation where it is not fair. I have a client right now who is appealing his case. And he's been locked up since 1984 for the crime that he's accused of having done. And it's pretty clear to most people that he didn't do the crime. And so people are arguing that the criminal justice system, he's been granted a new sentencing hearing and the wheels of justice are turning and eventually he'll get justice. And I say, what kind of justice is it to be locked up for a crime you didn't do since 1984? But there is a sense among many people that this is a problem, and I think there's a growing number of people who are becoming activists around the death penalty. Some reasons for the injustices that happen are a lot of the bad evidence that's presented comes from jailhouse snitches. And those are people who have been a cellmate with this person or who have gotten to know someone in jail and who make a deal with the prosecutor saying, I will tell you what I know that this guy has said to me in confidence if you'll give me a shorter sentence. So it's such tainted evidence because there's so much at stake for the snitch that's really been the cause of many problems. Another cause of problems has been other kinds of informants, street informants, that are unreliable. The gold standard of evidence is supposedly an eyewitness, but I have to say to you that the human brain is not a camera, and we don't remember things very well. We're not good eyewitnesses. Study after study on, showing people stuff and then asking them questions about it shows that people don't remember things. I myself had a robber at my back door in full view of me, and I was standing on the kitchen phone calling the cops, watching the guy trying to pick my lock in my back door for about 3 minutes, I think. It may not have been that long, but it seemed like a very long time. Well, I was calling the cops were asking me questions, and we finally came to an agreement that the cops would come. This guy was kneeling by the lock on my back door, which is a full window door. And the cops got there and said, what did he look like? And I didn't know. I mean, I didn't know if he was black, Latino, white. I didn't know. I just didn't know. I mean, I was too upset. I was trying to save my life. I wasn't paying attention to him. It wasn't my problem what he looked like. My problem was getting the cops there. So, I mean, I don't think I'm a stupid person, but I just didn't know what the guy looked like. And the cops, of course, rolled their eyes. I had two children in the house that I was trying to protect. So we're not good observers. And so when people are convicted on the gold standard of evidence, which is eyewitness, it's often a mistake. People make mistakes, And one of the things is that we show people a lineup, like you see on cop shows all the time. You know, you see those sort of six guys, solemn-looking guys, standing there in a lineup. And the witness looks them over and says, well, that one looks the most like him. You know, they pick out what they think is the right answer. And they've proven now that if you show lineups with just one person at a time going out for the eyewitness to look at, that the level of mistakes is much lower, because they don't choose any of them if the guy isn't there, or even if the guy is there, maybe. But what they found is that it doesn't mean that they lose more cases, but it does mean that they don't make as many mistakes. And then there's police and prosecutorial misconduct, which is the video I'm going to show you of Leroy Orange, who is someone who has been on death row since 1984, and for a crime he most likely did not commit, but he confessed to it. And the previous Raymond that I told you about confessed to his crime too. Almost all of my clients confess. And there's just too much production of confession that goes on in police stations behind closed doors. So that would be an easy thing to address. You could have videos on all the time. He was tortured into confessing, and he'll tell you on the video, but he's so embarrassed. He's so personally private about it. I mean, the torture involved things like electric rods up his rectum and a typewriter bag over his head so that he passed out from suffocation. And he just mumbles this stuff out, so you'll hear some of it on this video, but not all of it. But what happened is that a whole bunch of other guys said the same stories, and finally the lawyers started comparing notes and realizing that all these guys all had the same story, and they were all regarding the same five policemen from Area 2 in Chicago. And so then a pattern started to emerge, and then finally now there's been some a panel impaneled to investigate this, these cops. But in the meantime, all these years that these people have been lost. Confession is, remember when that rich young heiress, Patty Hearst, the newspapers at that time talked a lot about how when we're imprisoned, we're eager to please our captors. And there's some phenomenon of wanting to buy into that whole thing, and I think that that happens to a lot of people in jail. So there are reasons for confessions that are psychologically understandable if you think about it. I'm going to show that video now, and then we'll have a little discussion. Are there any questions before I show it? It's 10 minutes long. Oh dear, I better just show it. Would you stand up and press the button on the top of that machine where the white sign is up at the top, on the side, on the side, right above that sign? Yeah, press that, and then let go of it. It's working. So in just a minute, I'll start that. Are there any questions or comments while we're letting that?
The screen down.
Yeah, screen down. Good idea.
How long did you do this?
Only for a year and a half. So I don't know much about it. I was a college professor for 31 years and got into this business only very recently.
How many clients do you have at one time?
I have five, which is a full-time job. That's as much as I have time for. One of my favorite things about it is spending time in the jail. And what I find works well in the jail is making friends with the guards and being respectful of being who's there. So I'm, without any exceptions, I say hello to every inmate who walks by. The inmates have, they have a tape down the hall, taping off about one quarter of the hallway in every jail I've been in. And the inmates have to walk in that little quarter of the hallway, and the rest of us get to sashay down the wider part of the hall. But I look everyone in the eye, I say hello to everyone, I say, how are you doing to everyone? And I talk to the guards about their families. The guards are mainly minimum wage, they don't have a nice job, And if somebody treats him like a human being, they are quite responsive to that. I mean, there are some guards that are sadists, you know, sadistic people, but the jail is just another human plane where people are. And so the guards kind of don't like it that I greet every prisoner who goes by, and you know, but I figure this is tough. It's life. And I get a lot out of going to jail because the prisoners ask me about my life. They're respectful and kind. They're regular. They're human. They have gifts and talents. They have good advice about stuff. They're really quite a gift in my life. So I appreciate that. And often their families are. When I go to see their families, they can't believe it that someone's willing to come and just sit in their kitchen and talk for a long time and listen to stories and want more about the story and attend to the story. I sometimes have the sense that even if one of my clients is killed, which is, you know, probably going to happen one day, that the fact that I paid attention to them, I paid attention to their story, that their life has not gone unremarked, is going to be important. And the other thing I do, even though I'm paid by the state, is I talk about their faith. It's pretty easy to do because, of course, they're on death row or facing this possibility of being on death row, and they're thinking about this issue. And in jail, the pastors tend to be hellfire and brimstone sort of pastors who don't talk a lot about grace. But we can, in the privacy of our dungeon basement. So we sing hymns, we pray, we talk about what we think death is, we talk about grace and forgiveness and reconciliation. And the other thing that I can do, and I'm allowed to do, but often people in my position don't do, is I can go to the victim's family, and I can ask them if we can talk. And since the prosecutors seldom talk to the victim's family, the fact that the defense comes, and I don't come with an agenda, but I come because I believe in reconciliation and forgiveness, and I just take whatever anger and understandable grief and sadness and fury they want to dump on me. I mean, that's what I'm there for. And then I talk about what they want. And it turns out it's not often helpful to people to get the person who killed their loved one killed. That's just perpetuating the cycle of violence. So sometimes, I have to say that I have not yet succeeded in doing this, but I'm going to, I think, in about 2 weeks, because I have someone that I've tracked down and figured out how to approach her, and the wife of that jewelry store man. And I just think it's important to do. And the stories of my friends who do this work, who have done it, are incredible. The stories of they can't make friends, really. Sometimes they can. Sometimes the victim's family and the guy on death row's family can make friends. But at the very least, they can feel honored and heard by the defense. They can receive the defense's sympathy. And we can start talking about what should happen next. This is an excerpt of Bill Curtis, who's a reporter in Chicago. He does something on A&E, Arts and Entertainment, on legal issues often. He's a lawyer, and this is something he did on the death penalty. And my client, Leroy Orange, who's there, is in this. So you'll see that.
Our courthouses and legislatures reflect the importance we place on law. Laws that guarantee fair trials, especially when the state imposes death as punishment for the crime. But in this special edition of Investigative Reports, we find the death penalty itself on trial, not on moral grounds alone, but on whether it's being applied fairly. In the first hour, our case is involved in incompetent defense, judicial prejudice, and jury misconduct. In this hour, we examine how prosecutors and police can abuse the system and fairness, which could result in the ultimate inequity, executing an innocent person. 2000, then presidential candidate George Bush swore that the 150 people executed while he was governor of Texas were all guilty.
And as far as I'm concerned, there has not been one innocent person executed since I've been the governor.
Others are less confident. While some say the 68% error rate shows the system ultimately works because the errors were eventually caught, and others argue the accuracy of those figures. The ultimate question is, has the United States executed an innocent person? No one knows for sure, but there are cases that have given governors, attorneys, and judges many sleepless nights. Here are three. These men all had past records, but they may have been innocent of the crimes they were executed for. In 2000, Gary Graham from Texas was executed for murder. He was convicted on the shaky testimony of a single eyewitness. Two other witnesses who said Graham wasn't the killer weren't called to testify. Graham's court-appointed lawyer, Ron Mock, lost so many death penalty cases, the Texas death row was nicknamed the Mock Wing after him. Leo Jones was executed in Florida in 1998 for the murder of a police officer. Two policemen assigned to the case were later dismissed for ethical violations. More than a dozen people implicated another man. Roger Coleman was convicted of the rape murder of his sister-in-law in 1982. His attorneys were inexperienced. The evidence was tenuous, and he had an alibi. He was executed in 1996. In January 2000, concerned that his state might execute an innocent person, Governor George Ryan of Illinois, well known for his pro-death penalty stance, made a groundbreaking announcement.
I now favor a moratorium because I have grave concerns about our state's shameful record of convicting innocent people and putting them on death row. I can't support a system which, in its administration, has proven to be so fraught with error and has come so close to the ultimate nightmare, the state's taking of innocent life.
It was a historic decision made not by a lawyer, but a former pharmacist.
Governor, you declared a moratorium on executions in Illinois. Why?
We had a flawed system, Bill, a system that didn't work. We almost executed innocent people 13 times, as a matter of fact. And you know, Bill, I don't have to say this, it goes without saying. If we're going to have a system, it's got to be perfect. Now, can we have a system that is? I don't know at this point.
To try to answer that question, Governor Ryan appointed a commission to study how fairly the death penalty was handed out in Illinois. Illinois is the only state that has a moratorium on executions. 15 other states considered moratoriums in 2001, but the arguments for them fell apart in the legislature.
It's been a very popular decision, it seems like.
You know what's popular, Bill, is the fact that people want fairness and they want accuracy. It was just the right thing to do. How do you execute an innocent person? I mean, there's just no excuse for that.
The catalyst for Governor Ryan's call for a moratorium was the fact that 92 people had been freed from death rows across the country, 13 of them from Illinois. In 1998, Larry Marshall of Northwestern University School of Law, one of the warriors leading the charge for the wrongfully convicted, held a conference bringing together as many of those freed as he could.
My name is Shabaka Brown.
My name is Sonia Jacobs.
My name is Randall Dow Adams. My name is Kirk Bloodsworth.
The image of seeing the faces of 32 people who could have been executed in error was haunting. Marshall's Center on Wrongful Convictions at the university was instrumental in getting nine of them freed. Marshall
Appointed staff at the center like to take cases where it's apparent justice has not prevailed.
I work for that lawyer.
They believe the Leroy Orange case is that kind of case. It involves accusations of police misconduct and torture. And a 9-year-old child who were friends of his. There were 4 key pieces of evidence against Orange. The least incriminating, a cocaine pipe linked to him, was found at the crime scene, and witnesses saw him leave the apartment that night. Tom Garrity, one of Larry Marshall's partners at Northwestern, is the lead counsel on the case.
There was no physical evidence that tied him to the event itself. There was evidence that he had been in that apartment, that he did know those people. I mean, that's how the police found him. I mean, his address book was found in the apartment. And Leroy doesn't deny that he knew the people who were murdered. He denies that he had anything to do with the crime.
There was also a phone call the state's attorney says Orange's stepbrother made, saying he and Orange had done something that could get them in serious trouble.
Stepbrother's
retired. The most incriminating piece of evidence was a confession that Orange gave to police after his arrest at the Chicago Police Department's Area 2. The station would later become notorious for what happened there. Orange's description of the events that led up to that confession began when he was taken to an interrogation room.
And he kept asking questions about whether or not they tell him anything. So he left out of the room. And I'm sitting there. The door opens, a hand comes to the door. Takes the light switch off. And they rush me. And put a
plastic bag over my head.
His interrogation continued for 12 hours.
Sometime during the early morning hours, he started with this electrical business.
Electrical business.
To have your body being controlled by electricity now. I recall that day thinking that I now know how a great victim of a woman was feeling. And at that point I decided to go along with
both Orange and his stepbrother were sentenced to death for the murders. Over the years, as Orange awaited his execution day, he heard stories about other African-American men who said they'd been tortured into confessions at Area 2. In fact, there were 9 men, all on Illinois' death row, who had stories strikingly similar to Orange's.
Aaron wanted to really work me over, and he was working over me. Punched and kicked me and put a plastic pipeline cover over my head and smothered me.
Leroy Orange was convicted of murder and sentenced to death based in part on that confession. He said he was tortured into giving. And then 9 other men said they were tortured into confessions in Area 2, and a pattern emerged. Weren't the combined accusations of 10 men strong enough to at least raise doubts, especially when they were on death row awaiting execution? Next on Investigative Reports, the Chicago Police Department looks into the death row 10's allegations of police torture.
So the last thing I want to say is that the death penalty is in this is being used in this country, according to its proponents, because we're in a war on crime. And the war on crime is fought with punitive measures such as the death penalty. Research shows us that the death penalty is not a deterrent to crime, so it's ineffective, it doesn't work. But we are in this war on crime. And people describe innocent people being killed as collateral damage, the way people who describe, you know, killing innocent civilians in countries where we have, where we're fighting wars. I think that the useful image here is, for example, in the state of Illinois, you could say the state of Illinois produces parachutes. We make parachutes to make money or something. And at least half of them work. Is that good enough? Collateral damage. I mean, even if you believed in the death penalty, which I don't, and we'll talk more about on Wednesday, for those of you who are interested in the sort of faith issues involved and the ethical and moral issues, you would have to say, you can't, it's tough to argue that you believe in making parachutes where only half of them work. So thank you very much for coming, and it's time for dinner. Actually, I have one more little thing I want to say. Justice Blackmun, he has a great quote. He said, when he finished his time on the Supreme Court, he said, I will no longer tinker with the machinery of death. The death penalty experiment has failed. Think about that.